My name is Matthew. I'm an alcoholic. Welcome back. If you're going to heckle, you got to go, Jay. So my mentors were kindly enough to let me do. I do a talk on the ninth step from time to time when I get a chance because I'm really passionate about it. I've had some incredible experiences because of it. And so I want to tell you the format for this next 45 minutes or so is going to be, I'm going to talk about the history of the ninth step, borrowing exclusively from scholarship that Jay did. And then I'm going to talk about my experience with the ninth step. And then we're going to talk about what the purpose or the reward of the ninth step is or are. So this story, I believe that everybody in this room and myself, I believe that my spiritual life and my spiritual awakening had to do with something that took place 103 years ago. And I think June 27th in 1908, something happened that changed the course of history for all of us, I believe. And it's just an exciting story, but it can be a very complicated story. So that's why there's chairs out here. And I'm going to illustrate the story using you guys. And I'm going to start, if Jay would come up and sit here, because I know you really would rather be Frank.
Absolutely.
So, this guy, Frank Buchman, was a young minister who started a homeless shelter for boys in the slums of Philadelphia. And he had great success in changing these kids' lives and turning them on to God and getting them to be productive people. He was passionate about it. He was very, very effective. But he ran over budget at this homeless shelter because he fed them well. Unlike most homeless shelters, they didn't get beans and rice. They got decent food because he felt that they needed to be treated with respect if you wanted them to bloom. Well, because he was over budget, there were six board members that decided that they were no longer going to allow this, and they cut the budget and said, look, you got to feed them gruel like every other homeless shelter and just keep doing what you're doing. And he was so angry and so bitter that he quit. He was filled with resentment against these six men, and he quit his job, and he found that he lost his effectiveness spiritually. He no longer was able to do what he was good at, and he sort of sank into a little bit of a depression, and he was obsessed with these resentments. He ended up going to Europe. His parents sent him on a little trip to Europe, and he spent all the family money that they sent him with, and he was vagabonding around Europe, and he knew that he was sick, that something was spiritually wrong with him because he lost his touch. He ended up in Keswick, England at an evangelical conference, and he went to see a minister who he thought would help him, and the guy didn't show up. He was looking for F.B. Mayer, a famous evangelical at the time, he thought could maybe tell him what was wrong and change his life and straighten him out, and the guy wasn't there. So he wanders into a little church and a chapel where there was a woman giving a sermon on the cross of Christ. And it's interesting that we're all drawing our attention to the cross of Christ. And while he was sitting there, in a very small gathering, even smaller than this, there were 17 people there, in 1908 on June 25th, he was looking up at the cross while he was hearing this, and the cross collapsed into the letter I. And he believed that God came into his heart, and he saw the error of his ways. In fact, the quote he says is, there was a moment of spiritual peak of what God could do for me. I was made a new man. My hatred was gone. I knew I had to write six letters to these men that I hated. He realized that the problem was not everyone else. The problem was the resentment that he was carrying. And he had this experience seeing the cross turn into the letter I. So he went back to his hotel and he wrote the six letters. And I think it's important to tell you what was in the letters, because this is the amends that changed everything. He wrote, I'm writing to tell you that I have harbored an unkind feeling towards you at times. At times I conquered it, but it always came back. Our views may differ, but as brothers we must love. I write to ask your forgiveness and to assure you that I love you, and I trust by God's grace I shall never more speak unkindly or disparagingly of you. And he sent these six letters out, and he felt immediately the grace of God in his heart. And the litmus test happened when he went into the hotel he was staying in. And in the lobby of the hotel, he met a Cambridge student and explained what had just happened to him. And the guy converted on the spot. He
he once again had the touch. He could change men's hearts. And it came back to him through writing these amends letters. So Sam Shoemaker Frank Buchman goes back to the United States and he goes to Penn State and he has great effect. He actually turned the bootlegger around there. Bootlegger was a bad drunk. He figured if I get the bootlegger, I can help all these college students that are getting all their booze in the bootlegger. He tells the guy to write an amends letter to his wife. The guy never drinks again. The amends had this profound effect. Well, he goes off to China. Frank goes off to China in 1917, and he has a very intimate, intense conversation with a missionary over there in China named Sam Shoemaker. And Sam Shoemaker, because of the intensity of Frank Buchman's stories and his clear spiritual heart, is won over and confesses to him. He says to Frank Buchman, he says, "You know, I'm a spiritual fraud. I pretend that I give my whole life to God, but I keep the trump cards in my own hands." And Frank sits down with Sam and says, "Well, there's something. Let's do a little bit of an inventory and see what's going on with you." And Sam confesses that he hates China and he doesn't like what he's doing there. And so Frank suggests he makes amends to his Bible class, his Chinese student. So he goes, How about you, Zach? Can you sit next to him? So 1908, 103 years ago, Frank makes his amends. 1917, he passes this trick on to Sam. Sam goes to his class and says, "I hate to tell you guys this, but I hate China." And he makes amends to his class. And it says, "The admission produced such a profound spiritual experience that Sam Shoemaker worked closely with Frank Buchman for the next 21 years. It changed his life forever. That amends, that one movement, that one spiritual act changed his life forever. They ended up going back to the United States, and Sam Shoemaker founded the Calvary Church, or became the minister of the Calvary Church, which was a hubbub of activity for what was called the Oxford Group, which was Frank Buchman's group, first century Christian group. And the Oxford Group would have things called house parties. And house parties are like AA conventions, bless you. And AA conventions are, you know, house parties were like they'd have speakers come and talk about their experience, strength, and hope. Okay, so I need someone. Would you, sir, please sit right here and be Jim Newton?
Hold your sign up, Jack.
So, trying to keep the story straight. So Jim Newton is a salesman who's a drunk and has a lust for life, let's say. And he wanders in 1922 follows some girls into a hotel thinking they're going to a dance, and they're going to an Oxford group meeting, an Oxford house party. Well, he's so stunned by what he hears there that he wants more of the message, and Sam Shoemaker helps Jim Newton. Thanks, Sam. To see what's going on with him, Jim makes amends to his business partners for some ill dealings he had with them, changed his life completely. On the spot, he had a spiritual awakening by doing that step, by having that amends. The reason Jim is important to our story is he worked for the Firestone Corporation, and he tried to help Bud Firestone, who was the son of the owner of the Firestone Tires, to get sober. He had a lot of difficulty, so he brought Sam in on the job, and they get Bud Firestone to turn his life around through working these four or five steps that they'd come up with, and the third one being making restitution. The reason that's important is the Firestone people are so impressed that they invite the Oxford group to have an Oxford house party at the Mayflower Hotel in Akron, Ohio. Does that hotel ring any bells for anybody?
Yep.
So in attendance at that Oxford group house party is, I need you to sit right here.
1908, 1917 amends, 1922, 1933, Henrietta Seiberling goes to the house party, starts to see what's going on. Who knows who she is?
Dr. Bob.
She knew Dr. Bob, right? She was friends with Dr. Bob. They had Oxford group meetings in their home. She catches fire with this thing, goes off to see Dr. Bob. Well, also in 1933, in 1933, Sam Shoemaker's over there doing the work at the Calvary Chapel, and he ends up, actually through a book, this guy Roland Hazard has an experience and ends up working closely at Calvary Church, and he catches fire with this thing, and he has a spiritual awakening. What year does it say there? 1933. Well, he goes off to look for somebody to help, and he has an old childhood friend. And his childhood friend, John Gunner, is going to play.
His name is Eddie Thatcher.
So you're starting to see how in 1908 all of our lives got changed? Because who's Ebbie Thatcher? Ebbie Thatcher is the guy mentioned in Bill's story. Richard, will you come up here and be Bill Wilson? So, Roland Hazard works with Ebbie Thatcher in 1933. In 1934, Bill Wilson, as we know, has the awakening in the hospital, makes restitution to those people. And lastly, I need one more guy to just come up and stand here, Bill. And who does Henrietta Seiberling introduce to Bill Wilson? And who knows why, what happened on the day that we founded Alcoholics Anonymous? What is that day, Founders Day, based on? It's Dr. Bob's last
drink.
And what happened that day?
He made all his amends. Do you see how powerful this is? What if he hadn't have done that in 1908?
We wouldn't be sitting here.
What if they hadn't followed suit? What if these two guys hadn't have done it? Right? The idea that I'm trying to impart to you is not only is it a fantastic spiritual tool, an amazing thing to change our life, but if you don't do it, you're cheating someone else. If you don't do it, you're not being spiritually effective. And now, if you guys would all sit down to a rousing round of applause. So, there is one other character that I'd like to talk about in this play. But I think this guy is so incredibly good looking, I was going to play him myself. Matthew in 1993.
Matthew!
So because of 1908 and Frank Buchman, when I came to AA, I had a conversation with my sponsor. And on my 60th day sober, I was walking out to his car. And I said, God, you know, I can't believe, I was walking into a meeting. I said, I can't believe how much I love my little girl, Phoebe. Before she was born, I thought it was the worst thing ever. And now, 2 months later, I can't imagine loving anybody more than I love her. And he just walked right by me. And I went into my meeting that night, and I'm very sensitive, and I was looking at him across the room, and I was trying to convince myself that he was deaf in his left ear. Because there was no other reason anyone would be so cold to a guy talking about how much he loved his daughter. So we walk out of there, and I'm following him to his car. He drove me to meetings sometimes. And I said, maybe you didn't hear me before, but I think I love Phoebe more than I love myself. And he turns to me and he puts his hand up in my face and he says, how much child support do you pay? And I said, well, God, I work at that newspaper from midnight to four, stacking newspapers on a loading dock. And then I do that job driving packages around. And he said, yeah, I know that. How much child support do you pay? And I said, well, I don't pay any. And he said, then you're kind of full of it, aren't you? And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, this is a program of action, Matthew. This is not a program of talk. He said, you go to 7 gazillion meetings a week. You must know that by now. A 60 days sober. And he said, why don't you not ever tell me again that you love her? Why don't you just show me and I'll know? So we had a real quiet ride home. In the car on the ride home, it was quiet. I planned his death, and he lived in the present moment. which was uncomfortable for me. And I was filled with righteous indignation, and I went back to my parents' house where I was living at 31 and went to my old bedroom where the poster of Eric Clapton that I put up when I was 14 still hung on the wall. And I was trying to hold on to my righteous indignation in my old bedroom at 31 years old, marching around with 60 days sober, thinking I had to find another sponsor. Yeah. And as Eric and I debated this, I realized that the reason that my face was so red was that he was right, is that I was all talk. And in fact, I've seen what he saw later on with sponsees, is what I wanted to be was validated as a good person. And I picked something that could be universally validated, is this man loves his daughter. And he saw right through it that what I wasn't talking about loving my daughter at all. I was talking about, look at what a good guy I am. And so walking around that bedroom, I got really uncomfortable. And I went to the phone, and I didn't call him and break up with him. I called Anna, and I said, "Hey, Anna, I should probably give you money to help out with raising Phoebe." And she said, "Oh, man, that'd be so great. I'd like to go to college, and I can't really figure out how I'm going to do it." And I said, "Well, how much do you want? You know, I had these two crappy jobs. I made no money." And she said, "Oh, no, let's not do an amount." She said, "Let's do a percentage of your pay." And she was betting on my horse, see, but I didn't get that. I thought my horse was lame. And I said, "Okay." And she could have said, "I want 80%, and I would have given it to her because I didn't have enough to live on anyway. I was living with my parents. The money I was making wasn't something I was holding on to. But she didn't. She mentioned a very reasonable amount. So I took that money over there every 2 weeks. Every 2 weeks, I used to have to go. I don't know if they have them here. Do they have these places that have signs out front that say, "You're such a loser, we're going to cash your paycheck and take part of it before you can"? Yeah, I had to go there on my way and then pay in cash. And, you know, I want to be honest, there aren't a lot of new people here, but I only did that for two reasons, and neither of them had to do with how much I love my daughter or being a good father. The first reason was I didn't ever want to drink again. I really didn't want to drink again. And the second reason was the only spiritual experience I was having was sitting with Phoebe. I was a newcomer in AA, and I was scared and I was full of fear, but this little innocent wanted to sit on my lap and pull on my face, and I had someone who had no agenda for me in my life, who I was connected to. And when I went and paid that money every 2 weeks, I felt like I could get by the parents of that teenage girl, and I wasn't the biggest jerk in the world, and I felt like I was paying my way. And, you know, I want to say those people never were mean to me, ever. Those people whose daughter I got pregnant, we're very close. Yeah. Really, they're good, good people. And they showed me what good people act like. But every 2 weeks I'd pay this money, and I would come into meetings. We have a lot of big speaker meetings and stuff in L.A., and I would go in, you know, and some people would see me, and the crowd didn't jump up and burst into applause. And I was confused. And I go to my home group and I'd look around and I'm like, "Where's the Matthew Pace child support? He's a hell of a guy, Grapevine article," you know. And, you know, because you, right, we want a parade, right? We want to, for doing what, like, you know, when you got your license and you got your registration and you're 60 days or 6 months sober, and you go up to your best friend and you go, "Hey, I got my license." And they go, "Hey, you're 40 years old," you know. Wow. Yeah, it's like that. So... But you guys didn't know, and that was the thing is, I did it and you didn't know, right? And after a while, I realized that was the best part. That was the most important part. And I told some of you about the prayer I prayed when I held Phoebe in my arms in the hospital. I prayed the prayer that she would never see me again and that her mom would never see me again. And it was a righteous prayer because I was a destructive person. But I can tell you the moment that the amends had a really profound effect on me, and I was sitting with Phoebe. She's about 1 year old, because she could stand up. And we were kind of shucking and jiving. And I'm going, "Hey, I'm going to take you to your first day of first grade. I'm your dad." And then it dawned on me, that means I'm going to take her to second grade and third grade and dances and buy her a car. And I was filled with happiness. And I was like, "Phoebe, I'm going to know you for the rest of your life. Isn't that great?" And a year before, I wanted her never to see me again. And the only correlation, the only thing I did was I paid that money every 2 weeks, for reasons that weren't entirely noble. So that's one thing. And we could argue that's not an amends, but it may not be an amends to Anna, but it's an amends to Phoebe. Phoebe didn't have a dad around all the time, but she didn't want for anything. So I want to tell you one other amends story, and then we're going to have Sarah read something, but I owed a guy $15,000 when I got sober, and to some of you that's nothing, and to some of you that's a lot. Well, to me, in 1993, it looked like, when I wrote it down, it looked like $10 million. I was like, "Wow, that's not going to happen," you know, because I was paying child support now and living with my mom and dad and never, ever going to be able to make enough money to move out. So I went to my sponsor with my 8-step list, and I said, "Hey, I got this guy, Larry, and I ripped him off for $15,000 kind of gradually. He had moved away from my apartment. He kind of wanted to keep it. The lease was in his name. He had a room there. So he would pay his rent, and he would pay the whole rent, and I was supposed to send him a rent check, and he lived in Mexico City. And every month I'd go, "Are you kidding? The Mexican mail still has not delivered the check." Yeah, 'cause every month I lied. And he knew, but he didn't know what to do. He was all far away. Well, it added up to $15,000. I did a couple other things where I stole money from him. So when I got sober, I saw this guy, and he was a good man. You know, he's a good person. And I went to my sponsor and said, I got this guy, Larry, but I don't think I can do that one. He said, why not? And I said, well, I don't have $15,000. He said, do you think that you have to show up with a briefcase of $15,000? And I go, I don't know. Do I? Well, I don't know. And he said, well, you're kind of grandiose. He said, how much could you pay him if you could pay him right now today? I said, today I could give him $10. He said, then give him $10. And I said, well, he's in Mexico City. He said, write him a letter. And he said, before you mail that letter, I want to see it. So I wrote this letter, and then I showed it to my sponsor, and after he took out all the self-serving parts, it was a really short letter. You know, yes, I'm the devil, but here's why, you know, and... So it became very short. I took his suggestions. I put a check for $10, and I sent him $10. And I sent him $10 every month, and I kept a note in a little book. Because when I'm paying you back, I keep strict track. When I'm ripping you off, I have no idea how much money I took. But I sent him $10, and I sent him $10. And then after a while, I made more money. I got a better job, which I think is because I was sending him $10. Quite frankly, I believe in that sort of mystical aspect of this whole thing. And I could send him more, and I sent him $50 sometimes. And sometimes I sent him $100. And sometimes I didn't send him any. I missed some months, but I kept track. So I knew when I missed some months. And it wasn't like he wrote a thank you note every month. I just sent the money, right? Well, he moved back to Laguna Beach, kind of near where I live. And he called me one day. It was 7 years into it. I paid him $7,000, and I owed him $8,000. And I got to tell you what that felt like. It felt like once a month, walking out to an empty swimming pool in my backyard and taking an eyedropper, and going, "Someday I will swim." You know, it felt like the Sisyphus on roller skates. And so, I paid him $7,000 over 7 years. And he called and said, hey, Matthew, stop sending me these checks. And at this time, Bill's my sponsor. And I said, stop sending me these checks. Why?
Wayne.
No. Oh, it's right. It was Wayne. I said, stop sending me these checks. Why would I do that? And he said, I don't know what you're doing, man. And he said, but you've really become the guy I always thought you could be. He said, you know, you're a pretty good dad. You're really good to your mom and dad when they were sick. And your mom passed away. And you've been really good for your dad. And he goes, you're just a good person, and you've paid me back 100 times over. You don't need to pay me. And I made the mistake of calling my sponsor to brag that I'd finished, right? I'm done. I paid the guy back. And I forgot it was Wayne. And Wayne said, oh, yeah. He goes, that's that guy you paid $10 a month to when you live with your mom and dad. And I said, right, I did the right thing. And he said, and now you got this great life. He said, hey, man, you want to quit doing what's working? That's cool. And, so I guess the moral of the story is do not call your sponsor. Yeah. It was like the Wizard of Oz. I thought my house was, you didn't pay the money back. So I called Larry and I said, man, I gotta pay you these checks. And he didn't really understand. He said, okay, whatever. And then a few months later, my father died. And a few months after that, I got some money from my father's will. And I knew what I needed to do. And I wrote a check for $8,000. And I put it in a FedEx envelope because I didn't trust the man. That would have been my alibi. And I sent overnighted this thing to Laguna Beach. And with God as my witness, this is what happened. Larry called me up. And he said, you are not going to believe this. He said, I'm sitting here looking at my wife, Wendy. We just found out we're going to have a little baby boy, and we'd really, really want to buy this house we're living in. But we've worked it out 6 ways from Sunday, and we're just almost exactly $8,000 short of a down payment. And your check came. So the flake, the loser, the animal, got to help a guy with perfect credit buy his first house. With his own money. whatever. I always think that screws up the story. It kind of, there's a dramatic feeling, and then it's like, ooh, yeah, that was his money. And But that was pointed out to me long ago. If you're going to tell that story, you have to point out it's with his own. It's not like you're Santa Claus, you know. And I just held it till he needed it. That's how I look at it. And but so what I'll tell you is, when someone comes to me and they ask me to sponsor them, and if you've sponsored more than two people, you've heard this, and they get to their eighth step and they say, "I think I'm going to put myself on the top because clearly I've hurt myself." Anybody else heard this? Clearly I've hurt myself the worst. Well, I have liked to say sarcastic things, and I don't. I always say the same thing, always. I say, "You know what, man? Why don't we put you down at the bottom? And after you've made all those other amends, I think you will find it's no longer necessary to make amends to yourself. Because they're all amends to yourself." And I can tell you, with all honesty, I would pay $8,000 every year, to live the way I live inside of me. I'm clean. And I have a feeling the reason I sponsor so many people is because I've done this. I have a feeling I had the same effect that Frank had on Sam, that Sam had on Jim, that they all had on Henrietta, that they had on Roland and Ebby, and Bill and Bob, and every one of us. So my effectiveness, my spiritual effectiveness, I believe, is based on that step. I think did more for me than anything else. And you know, we have these meetings in Los Angeles and Redondo Beach or Hermosa Beach in the back room at noon, where you're supposed to read a paragraph from the Big Book. And a very popular paragraph that people land on is, the spiritual life is not a theory, you have to live it. You know, we have the third step and the 11th step that are pretty broad stroke spiritual, you know, steps. But you know where that is in the Big Book? The spiritual life is not a theory, you have to live it. Anybody want to guess? It's nine. It's in nine. It's in making restitution. That's living the spiritual life that this guy did, Frank Buchman. And because of him, 103 years ago, I had those experiences in 1993. So now I would like Sarah to talk about the fruits of the ninth step by reading the promises.
Sarah. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor shush up the dorm. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves.
So that's Bill's testament to what happened. I can tell you that's my testament too. That's happened to me. And now I'd like to invite my mentors to give their 2 cents if they wish to.
Thank you, Matthew. You want to go?
Yeah, I would. There's a real great line that comes right after what Sarah read, where Bill Wilson says, you know, our next function is to increase in understanding and effectiveness. You ever heard people in AA say, the longer I'm sober, the less I know? Aren't those people paying attention? You know? It's just spiritual pride. It's just BS. You know, I've been sober 26 years. I've made my amends. I've helped a lot of other people do it. I should know some stuff. And the psychic change really comes at the ninth step. That's when it really starts to change, when we really take responsibility for our lives. I've made a good number of amends, but I had one I'd like to share with you just quickly. It was the one I was saved to the end, and that I didn't want to do. It was very embarrassing. And I had a friend. He was the best man at my second marriage, Gardner, a guy named Gardner. He lived in Phoenix. And he was married to a woman whose sister, this young girl. And I was down there at their house, and I was drunk on my ass, as usual. And this young girl was 16, 17 years old, and I don't know how old I was in my 30s. And, you know, and I tried to force myself on this young girl. It was just embarrassing. You know, I didn't actually have sex with her. I did not have sex with that woman. But it was an embarrassing, embarrassing thing. And I remember waking up the next morning, and I was just embarrassed to tears, and I snuck out of that house and went back to the airport and went home. And I just pretended like it never happened, you know. And the few times I was around him after that, it was just really uncomfortable. And eventually I got sober. And what happened is this friend of mine killed himself. You know, I think he was one of us. He was a very troubled soul and a real brilliant guy. But he killed himself, and there was going to be a funeral. And his wife called me. We were, for a long time, we were very tight. So, you know, she wanted me and at that time my ex-wife, Mary, to come to the funeral, to be there at his memorial. And I knew I was going to see this girl. And man, I really didn't want to go. I was really embarrassed. I remember talking to Jay about it, you know, and I could have flown down there and made this amends anytime I wanted. And I was just simply afraid. And I don't know how long I was sober, 10 years sober, 10, 11 years sober, 12 years sober, something like that. And so I fly down there, and I'm sitting in the church, and this was at the Buick. And I looked around, I was looking for her, but years had gone by, and she was a grown woman by this time, and I couldn't pick her out. So I asked Sheila, her sister, and I know that they all knew what had happened. Nobody wanted to say anything. It was really pathetic. And she says, well, that's her right over there. See her there? You know. So I walked over to her, and she couldn't look at me. You know, she turned away. She pretended I wasn't even in the room. And I tapped her on the shoulder, and I said, you know, could I talk to you? And she goes, no. You know, it's no. Just like that. She couldn't look at me. So I turned and walked away, and you know, I'm just hyperventilating. And I knew I just couldn't let it go at that. You know, I mean, there is an ethic that if they don't want you in your life, don't go. I mean, you have to acknowledge their wishes. But I was in this situation, and I just needed to do it. I needed to get rid of this. And I walked back up to her, and I said, please, could I speak to you just for a minute? So she, okay. And we went around this corner, and I stood there, and I looked at her, and I said, she couldn't look at me. Her head was down. And I said, you know, I should have never done what I did to you. I said, I've been embarrassed and humiliated by it ever since it occurred. I've always felt bad about it. I did not get away with anything. And I want you to know how deeply and profoundly sorry I am for what I did. I'm sober now, and I look and I realize what I've done, and it's just humiliating. And I'm sorry. That should have never happened. And I'm a believer, and we don't ask them for forgiveness. I don't want to lay anything on them. It's not up to me whether they forgive me or not. I don't ask for anything. I just make my amends, and I try to clean it up as best I can. And, you know, she just kind of reached up and just grabbed my arm and then walked away real quick. The next day, we had the actual memorial, and I got up and said some words about my friend, and it was quite touching. The whole memorial was really something. He was an interesting guy. And we went to his brother's house for the, you know, buffet, you know, for everybody to sit around. And I'm sitting at this table in this guy's house. He had a big, beautiful house. And my ex-wife Mary was there and some other people I hadn't seen for a long time. And we were sitting there talking. And this woman came over and sat across the table from me and looked me right in the eye and just started talking like nothing had happened. And it was completely gone. And we forget, they carry this around too. She was ashamed. I just know she probably blamed herself. That's what happens to victims, you know. And by me making amends to her, she was looking at me, and it was as if nothing ever happened. She was laughing with me, reaching across the table and grabbing my hand, because it was just like she remembered me. You know, I was Uncle Bill. You know, nasty Uncle Bill. And I swear, you know, that one of the first thoughts I had when I left there is, why did I wait so long? You know, because we carry that stuff around with us, you know. And I, just like anybody else, I was afraid to make that hard one. That was a hard one. It was embarrassing, you know. And it's a powerful step. It's sober 101, though. It's just the basics. It's not the whole thing. But it's what gives us a message with depth and weight. the fact that we've done the inventory, we've looked at our defects of character and our shortcomings, we've written down, we've taken responsibility for our behavior, and we've gone and we tried to repair, and amends is about mending, trying to repair the bridge. And when we've done that stuff, we have a message with depth and weight, because we can speak to people from experience, not from theory. Most people in AA do not do this. I'm convinced of it. And they run around victimized by their own demons. You know, and they come up with lots of excuses. There's lots of excuses you can hear, like, we don't pay back the dope dealers, we don't do this. And I did not fall into that school.
Yeah.
I fall into the school that if we violated their trust, we pay it back. It doesn't matter who it is. We don't have to moralize about it. Well, that's, you know, that's a risk of their profession. Like, you know, we abuse cops. Well, that's just part of the deal. They have to take the abuse. You know? Now, I used to abuse cops. I'd yell in their face and stuff. You know what happened to me? I got asked to go speak at a police officer's AA meeting. I called Jay up, and he just went, you know? I had to go make amends to the assholes, and they weren't grateful for my amends. They just glared at me. But, you know, it was an opportunity. But that's all I have. Thank you.
I want to talk about not giving up. My father was a good-looking guy. He was smart. He was charismatic. And when he and my stepmother got together in the mid-60s, they were jet setters before they had a word for it. And they went all over the world partying. And they were so cool. She used to wear one of those little stick-on pearls earrings right down here when I was like 15 and 16 years old. And so that whenever my friends were over and were trying looking down their blouse, that she could catch them. And everybody loved to come by and see my dad and Marcia. But alcoholism's progressive. And my dad had it. And the coolest guy just became progressively worse. Now, he's the guy who told me that I reminded him of my Aunt Velma, who was the bad drunk in the family. And I was only 24 at the time when he told me that. And I thought it was the most outlandish, awful, hurtful thing anyone had ever said to me. And I got sober not that long afterwards. He bailed me out of jail. And when I got sober, I started trying to make amends for him. My first time I tried to make him amends for him, I had about 5 weeks sober. Got together with him for a cup of coffee, sat down, ready to talk to him. I started, he got up and walked out. 6 months later, I tried again. Same thing. He never once acknowledged my alcoholism. Of course, if he talks about my drinking, then his might be somehow discussed. Can't discuss that. One time, a sober buddy of mine, he had a couple tickets to an SC football game, and a buddy of mine who's sober, we just had over a year sober, and we're going to this thing at the Coliseum, I'm walking across the lawn with him and another young friend of his that was a couple years younger than me and my buddy, and my dad looks at me and he goes, "What good are you?" He said, "You don't drink, you don't gamble, you don't fuck around. What good are you?"
Good question.
Yeah, really. His moral compass. Yeah. Yeah.
he used to come over to the bar that my wife and I attended bar at, the Marriott over on Century, and pick gals up in front of my wife.
His dad was really his special guy.
And anyway, so I tried to get it 5 years. Nothing. And, you know, it was just one of those things that was always on my heart. And he would not sit down with me. You know, and I'm Mr. AA. You know, I mean, I'm, and yet he can't speak with my. I got a sister who gets sober, you know, and he never really got into the fact that she was sober, you know, and so anyway, I mentioned to you that time that, you know, again, there was this cycle in my life. There was a winter that came. My first family, it reached the point where I had to sit down with this woman that I'd been married to for 11 years and look her in the eye and say, I cannot live like this anymore. I can't live in a home without affection. I know that you love me and that you care about me and we have this daughter, but this is, if I keep playing the charade, something's going to happen, and I would much rather look you in the eye and take responsibility for my inability to create the kind of home that we both deserve. And move out, and then shortly after that, I start this step study that I told you about. Did that really good inventory, and I, when it came to my dad, I didn't know what to do, and I sitting there and. And it occurred to me, I'll write him a letter. So I wrote him a note, and the note said this: Dad, dear father, I've left my family, so I have now committed every sin that I have ever judged you for. Please forgive my arrogance and my judgment. Love, Jay. And I sent him the note. A couple days later, I got a phone call. He said, got your letter. Thanks. Click. A little while after that, I'm up visiting him. And, you know, if you're going to go visit my dad, you got to go in these sewer bars and hang out and pretend that he's clever, you know. And alcohol's just stripped all the cool away from him. And he got up to go use the bathroom, and the bartender looked at me and he said, you remember that letter you sent your dad? Yeah. He said he carries it in his wallet. A couple years later, my sister Regina was up staying with him, and she's getting calls from sponsees and all this stuff. She's real active. If you're ever in Las Vegas on Friday night, they got a meeting called Pulp Fiction. And she and her boyfriend Damien are there, and they'll be delighted to see you.
She's special also.
It's in the DNA. Anyway, my stepmother Marcia had passed away from cirrhosis of the liver. I'd been up and been helpful in that, because my father's drinking had prevented him from being able to love his wife in that fashion. After the funeral service, all his friends are going, what are you going to do about the old man? And fortunately, I'd been going to Al-Anon for a couple of years now. And by the way, I am a grateful member of the Al-Anon family groups. And my wife and my cat are happy every day.
My cat.
When I go to the Steps of Recovery Al-Anon family group,
I'm very pleased. Also,
it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. Anyway, so my sister's up, and Marcia's died. She's visiting my dad, and she's got all these sponsees calling, because she's a special needs person. She needs to, she can't work a light program. And my dad says, well, what is it about, oh, I'm sorry, excuse me, let me back up. Marsha dies, funeral, friends are saying, what are you going to do about the old man? I said, nothing. I said, I'm not doing anything. You need to talk to him, talk to him. And so I'd been going up there every other week for like 7 months, helping, and I was done. And so I gave it about 3 weeks after I'd left, after my stepmother passed, and I drove by just to see my dad. Now the ranch, 679 miles from door to door. It's a 10-hour drive when you're on it. And so I just happened to drive by. And I found my father in his chair, covered in his own waste, just unable to care for himself at all at 5:30 in the evening. And because I've been on 12-step calls, because I'm an AA member, I know what to do. And I'm able to pick him up, get him in the shower, clean up the waste, clean him up, get him dressed. Because I've done it in AA. And not be all offended and shit. You know, and just treat him like a drunk. And I said, Dad, you know, I've made a few calls to the VA, and we got a spot for you. We got a bed for you. And we're just going to go detox you. You won't have to go to the silly meetings. Because he was not, you know, the last DWI he got, he told the judge to just go ahead and put him in jail because he wasn't going to go to those silly meetings. And he said, and he got up the next morning and he said, no, been thinking all night, I'm not going. Really? And so I went and did what you taught me. I went and had a double espresso and said some prayers and talked to Bill and a couple other people. And because I'm familiar with the literature, when I'm driving back to the ranch, what comes across my heart is the line from Dr. Bob's Nightmare where it says, if you want to quit drinking on your own, that's entirely your affair. So I had my blueprint. I walked back and said, okay, cool. Can I get you some groceries? Bye. Leave. Tried to call him a couple times during the intervening week. Never heard from him. And thank God that I never called the neighbors. At the end of the week, I get a call from him. Hey, I'm about half angry with you. Really? Why? He said, well, I had no idea it was going to be that hard. And he kicked a quart and a half of vodka, half a case of beer, and 11 to 15 Vicodin a day by himself. And I said to my father, I said, you know, when I kicked that last time, it was so bad that I never wanted to do it again. And so occasionally my dad and I would have little conversations. What he'd talk about maybe having a Virgin Mary. I talked to him about, you know, the obsession of the mind and getting the thing started and all that stuff. And my dad quit drinking, quit using drugs. My sister. That was a dramatic pause. I'm sorry. Okay. seemed like I fell asleep.
Ladies.
I know this story.
He lived it. So anyway, he's talking with Regina, and Regina's getting these calls lobbed from her sponsees, and she says, you know, he says, well, what's a sponsor? And so she explains it to him, and he looks at my sister, and he goes, oh, I guess Jay is my sponsor. A few weeks later, my sister says, you better get up here. And he had really fast-spreading lung cancer, and I was able to go up there to be of service for my father. You know, as a man, all you want... It's for your father. think that you're courageous. And I was able to go, and I was able to walk my dad to the door. And it wasn't courage. It was a certainty that that promise from the ninth step had come true. You know, I had been reborn. I am not afraid of today or tomorrow or the hereafter. And I have no illusion for me that there is anything called death. Because of the experiences that I've had in Alcoholics Anonymous from working these steps. And, you know, it was an amazing privilege to be with him. The cancer was fast spreading, and I took him up to this hospital, and they were gonna cut on him. And I said to him, "Dad, they just told you that if they take a lung and you get all this chemotherapy, you got a 50% chance of living 3 years." And I know he hates doctors. And he goes, "Oh, those are pretty bad odds. What do you think we ought to do?" And I said, "Let's fold. Let's go home." I said, I'll be with you. And so I got to go and be there and to be of service to him. He chose to leave this life on the 25th anniversary of my coming to you, on the second day of May in 2004. And on that day, his mother was with him. His mother's still alive. She's 101. And
she's still real. She's special, too.
And
a special family.
And the two of them were able to be together in his last breaths. And Bill's known me, and Matthew's known me for a long time, and I was a spiritual weirdo.
Still.
Before. But when my dad left on that day, I knew. I didn't even have the slightest clue about how many veils there are. And I've dedicated the last 7 years to jumping as deep into it as I possibly can. And don't give up. You know, even if you got the one, you know, the nevers. And impossible things are possible. That man and I, it was impossible for us to be in the same room for many, many years. And yet I was able to go there and to be with him and to sit with him and to make sure that he had his dignity. And it's a wonderful gift. And it's a gift that keeps on giving. Because each of us have had that experience of walking our parents to the door. And in our home group, one of the things that we do is that we share that experience, strength and hope with each other. And when your time comes, as our friend Mildred taught us, you will know exactly what to do, because the power will be with you. The experience, the strength, and the hope of the women and men who have actually done the spiritual exercises will inform your every action, and their loving spirit will guide you. Thank you.
Next.
When his dad was dying, he brought him down to L.A. one time. In the last year of his life, he didn't drink, but it was remarkable.
Everybody.
Based on his sheer strength, you know. And he brings him by my house, and I'm sitting on the couch with him, and I said, "So, Jim, you're not drinking." And he looks at me, and he goes, "Yeah." He says, "You know what the best thing is?" I said, "No." He said, "I don't have to go to those fucking meetings." I high-fived him, man. The guy was a real demon, man. Just a demon. He was real proud of that.
Yeah. did give some cachet in the house.
My dad was sober a long time, and when I was a year sober, I made amends to him, and him and I had a real adversarial relationship most of our life. We didn't like each other at all. And I was a year sober, and I knew I had to make this amends, and I really didn't feel it. But I went in on his 70th birthday, and I told him, I said, you know, and he's in AA a long time, and I take him in this room, and he goes, you don't have to do this. And I go, you better than anybody know that I do. And I sat him down, and I said, I'm sorry that I wasn't the son that I know that you wanted me to be. I'm not going to list all the things that I've done. You were there. I said, and you're my father, and I love you, and I don't want to hate you anymore. And we talked a little bit, and I drove home that night, and it was like somebody reached down and just pulled all that rage out of me. I'd started sobbing, and I just couldn't stop. I mean, it was a real cathartic experience. I expected that he would make amends to me, and it didn't happen. And for 10 years, we got closer and closer together. You know, I found my father in Alcoholics Anonymous, literally. We reestablished our relationship. He became like Jay talked about, you know, his dad could finally look at him with pride. My father finally became proud of me. You know, I mean, I grew up and the relationship got safe. 10 years after I made amends to him, 10 years later, he made amends to me when I didn't need him to do it, when it wasn't necessary anymore. We had already mended our relationship and I wasn't looking for it. And it just shocked the living daylights out of me. You know, and he started crying. And this is a depression guy, self-made man. He don't cry. I mean, he got really emotional and reached across. I reached across the table to him as he was doing it. And I held his hand and I looked at him and I said, Daddy, it's okay. I'm right here. Because he got old and he got soft. They soften when they get older. You know, they get all squishy and stuff. You know, he never hugged me. And Jay told me, he said, you're so spiritually advanced, why don't you start hugging him first? If you want that kind of relationship, go get it. And I started, and slowly, and then at the end, he couldn't keep his hands off. Yeah. You know, I mean, it was absolutely wonderful. And my mother and I nursed him and took care of him. But don't leave before the miracle. I mean, we're all waiting around for. I went to Jay one time and I said, when are they going to start lining up to make amends to me? There's people that owe me amends. You know, a lot of AA people should be apologizing. And I'm always going around saying I'm sorry for my big mouth. When are they going to come lining up? You know? And the response was like, I've had to respond to people the same way. You ought to be damn lucky you can do it because you will reap the benefit of it. You know, the people that can do it are the ones that reap the benefit of it. Yeah. You know, that humbling, not humiliation. Getting humble, getting right-sized. And when I did that with my father, it had a profound effect on me, and only that I could see in hindsight. And when he made amends to me, and I was able to hold his hand, and in the end, when he was dying, everything was clean.
Yeah.
Between him and I both.
Yeah.
He just relaxed into this thing, man. I couldn't believe it. Everybody else is kind of flipping out, and my old dad's going, this is all right. You know, I mean, he was relaxed. He just relaxed into it and went through the phases. And we were there for him and changed his diapers and stuff. And there was no sense of, you know, loss of personal dignity or anything. When my mother died, I was standing by the bed with her to change her diaper when it was time to do that. And she thought she had lost her dignity. And she looked at me and she said, I never raised you to do this. And I stood there and I thought about it, and I remembered that house that I grew up in. Remember the story I told you with all the weird aunts and uncles around when they got sober and I had all these and I looked at her and I said, yes, you did. I know what was going on in that house that I was raised in. You were saving those people's lives. And I live in a house like that today because of the way you raised me. And I told her, roll over. You know, and we went and we entered a level of intimacy we didn't know, and it wasn't the physical thing. It was love in action. Love in action. And what Jay described to you is he fell in love with his father. And his father fell in love with him. Matthew tells the same story. You know? I mean, you think you're gonna be grossed out by these things? No. They're the people you love. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, you develop a heart. You don't know that you didn't have one. Because you're taking everything so personal. And when you stop taking things personal and you realize that you're just part of a larger scheme of things, there's no revulsion about any of that stuff. You just do it. They did that for you. Mm. You raise babies. We end up being babies in the end.
When my dad was dying, he said, "I don't know how you wipe your ass, but that's a little harsh." And I said, and my response was, "I'm sorry, I'll get the next guy lining up to do this job in the hall for you, because I'm it." But we laughed about it. I just knew that fit in with your story. So should we answer questions?
Or are we done? What should we do?
What do you guys want to do?
There's
lots of questions. I know. It's up to you. How does it feel sitting there?
You want to take a 10-minute break and do some questions?
Or what do we want a campfire?
Yeah, let's do a smoke break.
Yeah,
Break. We'll ask you a couple questions and we'll have a fire. All right.
15 minutes. We'll be back in 15.
Cool.